I'm trying to do something very ambitious this morning. That's another way of saying I'm going to need you to really do a lot of work. Here's what I thought we might cover. I thought we might cover the nature of all human knowledge, religious and scientific certainty, discrimination and bigotry, the degradation of the environment, and the nature of the kingdom of God. I've tried to cut this down from its original length of 9 years. But I'm more serious about this than I have any sane right to be. So I'm talking about very big patterns today, because these really are the things that I want to try to connect. Here's what I think we want in life. Check me out as we go to make sure you agree. I think that we want to believe that we know and live out of truth rather than lies or self-deceptions, that we stand four square behind things like justice, goodness, mercy, and love, and that we and our beliefs and our actions help in some small way to make a better world. I think we all want that out of life. And we do it by knowing what's true and good, and then trying our best to serve what's true and good, no matter how hard that may be to do. However, built into the very way that we are built, and the very way that we try to serve truth and goodness, are all of the ignorance, bigotry, discrimination, indifference to the political, social, military, and environmental situations, nearly all the evil in the world, as well as all the good, and the enduring enemy of the kingdom of God. So on the face of it, this is not encouraging. Here's how it works, all this stuff. See if you agree. I'll start kind of abstractly, but I'll bring it down to earth. When we find the truth in any area, we get an attitude of certainty about it. In fact, that's one of the best things about finding the truth, that feeling of certainty. And our attitude of certainty is almost like a kind of spirit or feeling that sustains us and guides our thoughts and actions. I do not mean just narcissistically. I don't mean that we each just go off into some little room somewhere, decide what we like, and then lurch out and foist it on the world. It's not that small a picture. We're social animals. We have networks. We have friends. We have families. Most of us have had educations that bind us to certain ways of thinking. There's a whole list of things that we're checking with that we'll talk about a little more. When we develop our picture of the world, which defines not only what's true and false, but even what counts as reasonable or sane when you think about it, it's like building a big tub around us and getting in it. Now, there are other metaphors than a tub. You might think, well, it's more like building a house or building a fence, and all that's right. But I have a poem later about a tub that I want to use. So it's like building a tub around us. Think of the things involved that give you your most distinctive feelings of certainty in whatever areas are important to you. Here's a list I made for myself. See how many other staves in this tub of your world, the tub of reality, how many other things you would add. We get our picture of the world, I mean by that, we get our picture of what's true, what's real, what's good, what's just, what's commanding, all those things, reality. We get our picture of the world from role models and charismatic figures. I still have a great uncle that died probably 40 years ago, with whom I spent a summer when I was 13, and whose loving and almost wordless notion of what's real and good and true have remained with me as a checkpoint for almost everything in life. When I think of doing things, I think back of Uncle Kenny, and I just check off, whether I'd still do this if Uncle Kenny were watching. Now, that's kind of dramatic, but I'll bet you all have people like that in your lives that you check back. It's how we know what we think of as true or good. Also, people that we love or admire, parents and family, have influenced our world for better and worse. Clergy, for worse and better. Respected teachers and elders, we've all had teachers that we didn't respect, but we've all had at least a handful of those teachers that just really reached us. Maybe it's just a half a dozen, but teachers that really reached you in first grade or ninth grade or whenever it was, you never forget them. And they gave you kind of a touchstone in their area. One of mine was a ninth grade English teacher named Mrs. Williamson. And about 7 years ago, I was preaching in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I mentioned a story like this, and Mrs. Williamson came to mind, and I mentioned her, and afterward, a woman about my age came up to me and said, "Oh God, yes, we never forget Mrs. Williamson." And we were in her class 2 years apart and talked about the powerful lessons about life that we got from this English teacher. I mean, it's that powerful, and I think we all have these in our life. We get our notion of the world and what's true and good from our education. What we learned, where we learned it, how we learned it, who taught it to us, the time we learned it. You get one lesson about patriotism if you're learning it during World War II. You get a very different lesson about patriotism if you learned it during the Vietnam era. So it isn't just what we're taught, it's also when we learned it. All these things matter. And then logic. We're all more logical people than we give ourselves credit for. We can sense whether there's an inherent logic to these things that we believe in. We want one. We want things to go together somehow. Even if they're just going together in our style, we know the difference. And when new ideas and new possibilities come in, we check them against this and think, this isn't something I would do. This isn't something that would be right to do. This isn't even something that would be right to believe. You'll think of other staves in your tub or slats in your fence or walls in your home. But I would imagine that you have most of those and some others. And when a new idea presents itself to you, see if you don't at least unconsciously check with some of these things, just a quick check to sort of tell whether this is something you want to admit. It's kind of like a human body with T cells that are on the alert to detect infection and reject that, but to allow other things in. We have that too. See if you don't think so. Now, this idea of a tub, I like the picture, frankly, but the idea of a tub isn't to imply that we couldn't leave it or think differently if we wanted to, but why would we want to? It's home. There are a lot of crazy ideas out there, after all, and we try to keep our beliefs coherent enough that they have some family resemblances with the people and thoughts and books and movies and stories that we love. You could think of our tub as a form of life, if you want. Some have called it a form of life, a form of living, a way of living, a style of being, the way we and our people have chosen to shape and edit what we include in our world and our awareness. But the picture of the world we live in is much smaller. The tub is much smaller than the real world is. And that's the point. Now, if all this is too abstract, there's also a very simple way to think about it. You could also think of this as the Davy Crockett School of Certainty and Action. He was a great hero in Texas. Many people don't realize he was also a philosopher of sorts. At least he had one motto, and it's one of those mottos that's hard to forget. Davy Crockett's motto was, "Just be sure you're right, then go ahead." You're right, you have that necessary feeling of certainty about it, and when you're sure you're right, you know it's safe to go ahead. It's a better motto than we like to think because it sounds so goofy. Now, two areas where you might expect to find the most compelling sense of certainty might be among religious mystics and among scientists, whether those groups spoke to each other or not. Mystics, because once they're certain that they're in touch with or in tune with God, nothing is likely to shake them. And scientists, because they have to ground their beliefs in a lot of empirical data. They have to check them with the whole host of other scientists within their discipline. They have things like peer review. They submit ideas to other scientists, knowing they may be shot down, and that's a good thing. It's how the system works and polices itself. Now, this could mean, if you think about science or life, this could mean that some bright young scientist may come along with a new idea that simply can't pass the test, and they get their feelings hurt when their idea gets laughed off the table or they get laughed out of the room by really good scientists. That's the way it works. Honest science isn't about feelings. It's about trying to go through this kind of rigor before admitting something new into defining our world. Now, naturally, I have a story about this, one of my very favorite stories from the history of science. It involves one of the most famous scientists in the world and a bright young man who tried to get an idea past him that couldn't pass muster. It actually couldn't pass muster of any of the great scientists in the world, so he was pretty thoroughly defeated. But it's a story about almost everything that I'm trying to talk about this morning. It happened back in 1935 in England, at Cambridge. It happened in the field of theoretical astrophysics, so I'm not going into much detail. And it involves the great Sir Arthur Eddington, one of the greatest mathematical minds in history. Eddington, at the age of 52, was generally acknowledged as the world's finest astronomer, and his book on the structure of stars was the classic in its field. Now, the other character in the story was a very bright 24-year-old student from India named Chandrasekhar, or Chandra. He had been studying the structure of stars for only a few years since he won Eddington's book as a prize in a school physics contest. So it gives you some measure of the relative stature of these two. But the young man was not shy. And he had been discussing a radical new theory of his that disagreed with Eddington. He'd been discussing it by mail for several months, and he just wouldn't quit. So finally, Eddington invited him to London to present his paper before the prestigious Royal Astronomical Society at Cambridge. Eddington even told Chandra that he'd used his influence to get extra time so that the young man might present his work properly. Well, this is a career dream come true for a 24-year-old young Indian physics student. The day before the presentation, when a copy of the printed program was released, Chandra discovered that Eddington had also placed himself on the program, following Chandra and speaking on the same subject. Chandra's paper dealt with a fundamental question that I'll try to keep as simple as my own understanding of this is. What happens after a star has burned up all of its fuel? You still got all this mass left, but it won't burn anymore. What happens to that? According to the prevailing theory and Eddington's theory, the cooling star would collapse into a very dense ball called a white dwarf. So a star the size of our sun might collapse into a ball the size of our Earth, and then it would be white, very hot, and very stable. And, of course, you can find white dwarfs in the telescope, so there's lots of empirical evidence to support this theory. Chandra saw it differently, and he thought that if a star were big enough, like 1.5 times bigger than our sun, there'd be too much mass, and it couldn't stop at that stage, and it would just have to keep on collapsing and collapsing and getting denser and denser, and the atoms would be moving faster and faster in this until, well, he wasn't sure where it would go. And he sort of sidestepped that question at the end of his paper. Then it was Eddington's turn. The point of his paper, remember, this is done done in front of a room full of the most respected scientists in the world. He's not playing to fools. He's playing to people with the intelligence to catch him if he's wrong. The point of Eddington's paper was that Chandra's ideas were simply absurd. And he proceeded to tear apart Chandra's entire paper. The speech was frequently interrupted by laughter from the other scientists. If you're going to play in the big leagues, you're liable to get hit by the ball. Eddington couldn't quarrel with Chandra's logic or calculations, but he claimed that the whole theory had to be wrong, simply because it led to an inevitable and outlandish conclusion. And here's Eddington's brilliance. He saw the implications of Chandra's theory better than Chandra did. The star, he said, think about this. The star has to go on radiating and radiating and contracting until, I suppose, it gets down to just a few kilometers radius when gravity becomes strong enough to hold in even the light. And then the star can find peace. And no such object could possibly exist, said Eddington. He called it a logical reduction to absurdity, and he added in one of the great lines from the history of science, or religion, or anywhere else, "I think there should be a law of nature to prevent a star from behaving in this way." But I want us to see what Eddington did, because he's doing this whole picture that I'm trying to talk about, and he did it so well. He tested a new theory against a whole line of slats in his fence, staves in his tub, against all that he knew to be true and logical, against his immense knowledge of mathematics, against his ability to see patterns that seemed to go beyond young Chandra's. He even saw where Chandra's paper would lead and had to lead. He then presented it not to an audience of clowns and yes men, but to an audience of the very most rigorous, finest scientists in the world. This is as close to peer review as you can get in a short time. This is good science going on here. And everything Eddington checked this against convinced him and the room full of scientists that this was a bad idea, no matter how bright and how nice the young man was, and it couldn't be admitted into what we call truth. The argument with Eddington dragged on for years. It ruined any chance of Chandra's ever getting a tenured teaching position in England. This is powerful stuff. If you play in the big leagues and lose, it's powerful stuff. Finally, it persuaded Chandra to give up the subject altogether. He couldn't get any grants to study it, couldn't get any funding to pursue it, and he couldn't get much but laughter from scientists that he talked to about it. So shortly after giving up on being hired in the civilized world of Europe and England, he was hired by the University of Chicago in 1937. And he went to Chicago and put his theory in a book and then let it go and spent the rest of his career working in other areas where Eddington's brilliance and his power hadn't closed the doors. I mean, you know there's a punchline. Then in 1983, Chandrasekhar, still at the University of Chicago, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for the work he had done in 1935, 48 years earlier. What he had discovered that Eddington and all the finest scientists in the world said could not exist were black holes. The greatest mind in astronomy, surrounded by a room full of the nearly greatest minds in astronomy, had been wrong. Certain, but wrong. And the force of that dogmatic but incorrect opinion set back research on black holes for 5 decades. He couldn't quarrel with Chandra's logic or calculations, remember. He opposed the results simply because, as he said, and I do love this line, I think there should be a law of nature to prevent a star from behaving in this absurd way. Now, this isn't just about astrophysics. You can think of times in your life when someone said to you some variation of, I think there should be a law of nature to prevent you from doing this absurd thing that you want to do, or being this absurd thing that you think you are. This didn't happen only in 1935. Eddington, like that other hero, Casey at the bat, had struck completely out, though it took nearly half a century to find out. And the award wasn't presented to Chandra until 39 years after Eddington had died. So Sir Arthur Eddington had spent the rest of his life knowing he was right. The year before he won the Nobel Prize, Chandra looked back and tried to draw some conclusions from the story. He was a very, very gracious man. How can scientists of Eddington's caliber be so wrong and in such unscientific ways? These are the reflections, Chandra wrote, that cross from science into religion so smoothly. For lack of a better word, he wrote, there seems to be a certain arrogance toward nature which people develop. These people have had great insights and made profound discoveries. They imagine afterwards that the fact that they succeeded so triumphantly in one area means that they must have a special way of looking at science, which must therefore be right. But science doesn't permit that. Nature has shown over and over again that the kinds of truth which underlie nature transcend the most powerful minds. And now we're into pure religion. Take Eddington, Chandra wrote. He was a great man. He said that there must be a law of nature to prevent a star from becoming a black hole. Why should he say that? Just because he thought it was bad? Why does he assume that he has a way of deciding what the laws of nature should be? Similarly, this often quoted statement of Einstein disapproving of quantum theory, God does not play dice. How does he know? How does he know what God plays or doesn't play? I think one could say that a certain modesty toward understanding nature is a precondition to the continued pursuit of science. Nice stuff. From inside our tub, from inside Sir Arthur Eddington's tub, the tub that had all the other great astrophysicists inside of it too, all of our certainties are seen as the rules by which logical, serious, and sane people play. They see themselves as the gatekeepers and the guardians, not only of truth, but really of a kind of sanity. Because if you can't believe these things and see these things, you're not thinking right. And this is what they were saying to this young, brash Indian student 71 years ago. You're not quite right here. Your truth's wrong, your thinking's wrong, your center's wrong. To them, they were the guardians of truth and science and certainty, and that's a good thing, and we've all been there. But from the outside, that tub doesn't look like a tub of certainties or truth at all. What it looks like is a tub of denial. These are the walls of denial that kept them from seeing how much bigger the world was than they wanted to believe, how much different the world was than they wanted to believe, how many more possibilities there were in the world than they wanted to permit. Certainties from the inside are seen as denial from the outside. The more certain we get, the more firm the walls of our tub become, the harder it is for anything to get through, and the easier it is for everyone outside to say, we're just living in denial. Now, this is the human condition, I think. This is why I've wanted to think of this worldview as a tub. Because of the poem that I want to read. It was written about 20 years before Eddington's first meeting with Chandra. It was written in 1916. And it describes what happened to Eddington, but also what happens to many of us. It's taken from the book by Edgar Lee Masters called Spoon River Anthology. If you haven't read that, you might enjoy it. It's a very strange book. It doesn't quite have a plot or a script or this sort of stuff. The book simply consists in 100 or more of epitaphs taken from the gravestones in the mythical town of Spoon River, Illinois. Epitaphs in which the characters now get to reflect on their life and on life in general. And this is the epitaph of Griffey the Cooper. The Cooper should know about tubs, but I learned about life as well. And you who loiter around these graves think you know life. You think your eye sweeps about a wide horizon, perhaps. In truth, you're only looking around the inside of your tub. You cannot lift yourself to its rim and see the outer world of things and at the same time see yourself. You're submerged in the tub of yourself. Taboos and rules and appearances are the staves of your tub. Break them and dispel the witchcraft of thinking that your tub is life and that you know life. Wonderful poem. This is one way of understanding the human condition, the human dilemma. We live within small pictures of a universe that is sometimes infinitely larger than we can imagine, but we can't imagine an infinitely large universe, and we need some place to live. We need a home. And so we make a home within the small pictures that we're able to assemble and surround ourselves with. They give us our sense of order, of truth, of reason, of sanity, of justice, of goodness, of mercy, everything we get from the pictures inside that tub. And from the inside, we call it, with some fair amount of arrogance, we call it creating order out of chaos. And the order we impose through our picture, our paradigms, our biases, lets it feel at home, lets us feel certain, lets us feel sane. But from the outside, our wall of certainties looks like a wall of denial or willful ignorance, of an unwillingness or an inability to be moved enough by the vastness of it all that we can react not only with our minds, but also with our hearts. Griffey the Cooper nailed it when he said that we can't lift ourselves to the rim of our tub and see the outer world of things and at the same time see ourselves and still feel at home. I cannot think of a single field of human knowledge that isn't built this way, not one. Music, science, literature, not one. In religion, orthodoxy is the tub. Heresy is the voice from one looking over the rim of the tub, trying to find a way to make a home in a bigger world. And the very bigness of that world and the possibility that someone might make a home in it is what threatens the adequacy and the comfort of those within the smaller world of the orthodoxy. In society, we do the same thing. Our world's pictures, our tubs, tell us, now you'll recognize every bit of this. Our tubs tell us what kind of people and behaviors are acceptable and which are wrong. Our tub tells us what roles men and women may play and may not play, what kind of people we can and cannot love, what sexes, sexual orientations, or races are superior to the others, and all the rest of it. And we're sure we're right, so we go ahead. We're so sure we're right that we're often dangerous to those whose lives are lived in the bigger world outside of our tub. See if you don't think that's true. But it's everywhere. Yesterday was Earth Day, and our understanding of our environment is limited or enhanced in the same way. Is the earth here for us to plunder and have dominance over, dominion, or for us to be good stewards of as though our lives depended on it? One is a bigger tub than the other. A growing number of scientists are warning us that our greedy and uncaring treatment of our earth may have consequences more devastating than we can imagine. Many don't believe this. There are tubs and there are tubs. If the Arctic ice caps melt, they say Florida and New Jersey may be buried under 20 feet of water. Can we see over the rim of our complacency about using the lion's share of the Earth's energy and oil in time to make a positive rather than a negative difference and before our tub gets flooded? When we reach the end of our intellectual tether and our understanding can't include a world bigger than our mind can fathom, almost every religion in the world agrees that it's time to turn it over to our hearts. Buddhists say when we're faced with a choice of doing the right thing or doing the compassionate thing, do the compassionate thing. Jesus said, "What good does it do if you love those who love you? Even the worst of people do that." It's one of my favorite sayings. It doesn't get quoted enough. It's the saying that preceded the more famous one when he said, "No, you should love even your enemies." And the irony, of course, is that once you've loved your enemies, they're not your enemies anymore, and your mind couldn't accomplish what your heart can accomplish in an instant. No matter what religion you turn to or where in your own heart you turn to, I think you'll find the same advice. Poets like Edgar Lee Masters, who are 20 years ahead of the great Sir Arthur Eddington. Sages and prophets like the Buddha and Jesus were aeons ahead, it seems, of nearly everyone. Beyond the tub of our certainties lie the much bigger worlds that need our compassion and our protection. And the ability to love beyond our understanding is the path, many believe it's the only path, toward that idyllic picture of the world known as the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is the state of affairs where we simply treat all other people as our brothers and sisters and as children of God, and treat the entire earth as the handiwork of God and as the womb within which we have been born. Even more than understanding the world, we are called to bless it. That may still be the only path toward what Jesus once called the kingdom of God, and it may be the only path toward a great deal more as well.